through a combination of pressure and incentives to see if we can invite North Korea to make a different set of choices.
Developing a North Korea summit agenda. It's Tuesday, February 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, second thoughts along a Chinese railroad. We meet an Asian American playwright. President Trump about to share his State of the Union. Controlling cancer pain, women-centered workplaces. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Preparations are underway for the second summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While the date and location of the meeting have not yet been revealed, VOA Asia's Ira Melman reports the man who represents the United States in talks with North Korea has begun his task of coming up with an agenda for the summit, at least in part acceptable to both sides.
Senior U.S. and South Korean officials have met to discuss an expected second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump said last Thursday that he'll announce this week the site and date where he'll meet with Kim, expected around the end of February. Trump's special envoy for North Korea, Stephen Biegun, arrived in South Korea Sunday amid reports that he would meet with North Korean officials early this week to work out details for the summit. Monday, Seoul's presidential office said that Biegun met with South Korea's national security adviser to discuss the planned Trump-Kim meeting. Last Thursday, Biegun told a gathering at Stanford University in California that Washington is willing to discuss many actions to improve ties and entice Pyongyang to give up nuclear weapons, but set out an extensive list of demands for the North, including a full disclosure of its weapons program.
Before the process of denuclearization can be final, we must also have a complete understanding of the full extent of the North Korean weapons of mass destruction and missile programs. We will get that at some point through a comprehensive declaration. We must reach agreement on expert access and monitoring mechanisms of key sites to international standards. And ultimately, we need to ensure the removal and destruction of stockpiles of fissile material, weapons, missiles, launchers, and other weapons of mass destruction. All of this must be addressed in a roadmap of working level negotiations that will be essential if we are to put in place the necessary conditions to fundamentally transform U.S.-North Korean relations and establish a peace, permanent peace, on the Korean Peninsula.
Biegun did not elaborate on what concessions the United States might make, but said the corresponding measures demanded by North Korea would be the subject of talks next week. The U.S. negotiator said the United States is fully aware that Pyongyang has not fulfilled its promise to do away with its nuclear capabilities.
North Korea has a significant and potentially dangerous capacity in weapons of mass destruction. We all know that. North Korea has given us little indication that they have yet made the decision to completely dismantle and destroy that capability. We all know that. Therefore, what is the question? And what President Trump has done is directed the Secretary of State to engage diplomatically through a combination of pressure and incentives to see if we can invite North Korea make a different set of choices. That's the complete picture. It's not that we're deceived. It's not that we don't know what's going on. It's not that we don't take the threat with the gravity that it requires. And by the way, we have enormous capacities to deter that threat as well. So if I were presenting the same information, I would say that we have the potential here for grave threat to the United States of America. And therefore, it is all the more urgent that we engage diplomatically with North Korea to see if we can change the trajectory of their policies by changing the trajectory of our own. And that's what we're trying to do.
Biegun said, from our side, we are prepared to discuss many actions that could help build trust between our two countries and advance further progress in parallel on the Singapore summit objectives of transforming relations, establishing a permanent peace regime on the peninsula, and complete denuclearization.
President Trump is ready to end this war. It is over. It is done. We are not going to invade North Korea. We are not seeking to topple the North Korean regime. We need to advance our diplomacy alongside our plans for denuclearization in a manner that sends that message clearly to North Korea as well. We are ready for a different future. It's bigger than denuclearization while it stands on the foundation of denuclearization. But that's the opportunity we have, and those are the discussions we will be having with North Koreans.
Begin said the past 25 years of talk showed the possibility of failure was grave, and he stressed we need to have contingencies if the diplomatic process fails, which we do. Ira Melman, VOA Asia, Washington.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Philippine police say five church bombing suspects in custody. Record flooding hit Australia's northeast. Nissan cancels plans to make SUV in UK. Mothers of jailed Chinese rights defenders shine light on son's cases and injustice. United States and South Korean diplomats meet ahead of Trump-Kim summit. Where do you find expanded coverage of these stories? Well, it's on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A prominent Kenya newspaper reports that top officials may have imperiled key strategic assets when it signed a 2014 contract deal with China for the country's standard gauge railway. Salim Solomon has the story.
As it winds through Kenya's lush national parks, the Standard Gauge Railway, the country's largest infrastructure project since independence, seems like a symbol of progress. Some experts argue the railway will support Kenya's long-term development.
The Standard Gauge Railway is a real game changer. And now you have a railway where you can get on a train and you can arrive at the other end in 5 hours.
The railway connects Nairobi and Mombasa, Kenya's two largest cities. Before the SGR, it took 10 to 15 hours to drive between the cities on a stretch of poor roads.
That is completely game-changing for people movement, but I think perhaps more importantly for goods movement.
But a new report by the Daily Nation, Kenya's largest independent newspaper, suggests a hidden cost. It claims the multi-billion dollar loan with China to build the railway could imperil Kenya's sovereignty and assets. Details of the 2014 contract between Kenya and the Export-Import Bank of China emerged in early January. Beijing's infrastructure deals and the structure of its loans are typically kept secret. The Nation report says it obtained a copy of the pact and raised concerns on the scope of assets Kenya must forfeit if it defaults on the loan. The contract also stipulates that Kenya must use Chinese goods, technology, and services in the railway's construction and operation. A confidentiality clause prohibits the Kenyan government from disclosing the terms of the contract without Beijing's expressed written consent. The excerpts provide some of the most tangible evidence to date that Beijing may engage in what critics characterize as debt trap diplomacy, lending designed to force countries into handing over land, minerals, and strategic assets when they default on a loan. The Nation didn't reveal how it acquired the contract nor how it determined its authenticity. But language in the document closely matches contracts VOA reviewed for projects tied to the Belt and Road Initiative, China's trillion-dollar global infrastructure plan in Serbia, Kyrgyzstan, and Guyana. These contracts suggest the terms of the Kenya loan may reflect Beijing's lending practices across Africa and beyond. Since launching in 2017, the SGR has been marred by allegations of corruption, racism, and poor management. Both Kenyan and Chinese officials have faced criminal charges. President Uhuru Kenyatta pushed back against claims that Chinese lending has hurt the country.
My friends, we are ahead of our payment schedule. We are not tied to any country, but we are working together with those who appreciate and understand Kenya's developmental needs, China being one of them. China is a very, very strong supporter of Kenya's development agenda.
He added that Kenya will continue to borrow for development. I'm Salim Solomon for VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel has met with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Tokyo to emphasize the importance of free trade between their countries. They also agreed to step up cooperation on new security challenges. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We wish you a happy new year as we begin the Year of the Pig together on VOA Asia. One way to take in the new year is to perhaps see a stage performance. Kleptocracy is a play based on the collapse of the Soviet Union and is the work of award-winning Asian-American playwright Kenneth Lin. You may already be familiar with Lin's work on the second and third seasons of the hit Netflix series House of Cards. VOA Asia's Anna Cook sat down with Lin to talk about the details of his journey as an Asian writer in the United States.
You're good. So, I guess congratulations are in order. Congratulations.
That was a scene from Kleptocracy, the most recent work written by Kenneth Lin.
I wasn't always sure that I wanted to be a writer.
Kenneth Lin, now an award-winning playwright of numerous plays and screenwriter of House of Cards, says his journey as an aspiring Chinese-American writer was not always obvious and smooth.
It was hard at first because I even remember, like, I had managers and things like that. They were like, oh, you're a really great writer and we want you to do X, Y, and Z, but, you know, you must understand that we can't have stories that have Asian characters in them.
Since House of Cards, Lin's most recent project is a play called Kleptocracy, a fictional play inspired by historic events during the collapse of the Soviet Union, now showing in Washington's theater arena stage.
I would go out to Los Angeles by myself, and I would end up sleeping in rooms that had no furniture or sleeping in my car sometimes and, like, bathing with a baby wipe before meetings because, you know, I was so broke. But I knew that if I didn't put myself out there, if I didn't go and fall often, that I was never going to be able to do it. So it was a lot of just trial and error.
Lin's background, coming from a hardworking immigrant family, to this day is a core influence on his job as a playwright.
I spent most of my childhood in Long Island, where my family had a restaurant. And I grew up in this restaurant. So a restaurant is really very much show business. As a child, my grandmother always told me that, like, the best always has to go to the people who are coming here tonight. And I think about that in terms of my writing.
They say that Mikhail Borisovich Khodorkovsky is three generations of Rockefellers rolled into one man.
You know, I think we do come to the theater to be nourished. You know, I think of that as my job, is to nourish the people that are coming.
Upcoming works to look forward to from Lin include a musical adaptation of Farewell, My Concubine, and a TV show based on the writings of Bruce Lee called Warrior, all of which focus on Asian characters.
But at the time, you know, the world was different, and people really weren't looking for stories written by Asian people. Now I think things are different, and things are beginning to open up. I no longer feel as though I can't write about my Asian American experience, and it won't have an audience. You know, I feel pretty confident that it will now.
Playwright Kenneth Lin in a conversation with VOA Asia's Anna Cook. His latest play, Kleptocracy, is being performed here in Washington, D.C. at Arena Stage until the end of February. Coming up, we preview a major presidential speech. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The latest news from VOA Asia. Hundreds of potential candidates have begun to register for Thailand's first election since a military coup in 2014. And five suspected militants in a church bombing in the Philippines have surrendered to the national police. 14 other suspects remain at large. These stories and more can be found online at VOA 60. And visit the VOA Asia Facebook page each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, later today, U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to give his second State of the Union speech after a brutal fight with lawmakers over border wall funding, which triggered the longest partial government shutdown in American history. Against this backdrop, Trump will address a new Congress with a record number of younger members, minorities, and women. The president will also have to contend with Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to avoid another shutdown in less than 2 weeks. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has more from the White House.
Speaker, the President of the United States.
On Tuesday, Donald Trump will again step into the House of Representatives chamber.
The state of our union is strong.
This year's State of the Union address follows a brutal fight with Democratic lawmakers over border wall funding, which triggered the longest partial government shutdown in history. The shutdown pushed back the date of the annual speech.
His entire goal, right, with the State of the Union is going to be to try to reconvince his base that he is in fact strong, and that he is not in fact weak, that he didn't in fact lose, that that's been a, you know, fake news meme, and that he needs to correct.
The White House says this year's theme is Choosing Greatness, where the president will discuss immigration, trade deals, infrastructure, health care, and efforts to stop foreign wars, and that the tone will be unifying and optimistic. But experts predict there will be fewer calls for unity and more of this.
I'm the one that's trying to help you. They're the ones that are trying to block what I'm doing.
Last year, behind the president sat Paul Ryan, then House Speaker from his own Republican Party.
Thank you.
This year, Nancy Pelosi will be holding the gavel, a reminder that the 2018 elections gave the House majority to Democrats with record number of younger members, minorities, and women in Congress. In 2018, many women Democrats wore black to support the Me Too campaign against sexual harassment and assault. This year, a Democratic House group invited female lawmakers to wear white to mark the suffragette movement, which led to a women's right to vote in 1920.
To him, all of the women sitting out there wearing white is just a big statement of opposition, and the fact that half of the room definitely will not be standing up or clapping or cheering at anything he says. I think those things get under his skin.
Two more women in this political theater. Victorina Morales, the undocumented worker who was fired from one of Trump's golf resorts, will be the guest of a Democratic lawmaker. And Stacey Abrams, an African-American who garnered national attention in her unsuccessful bid to become governor of Georgia, will deliver the Democratic response, a signal of her party's focus on diversity and concern about the election system. On Friday, the president again hinted he may declare a national emergency to bypass Congress for wall funding.
Well, I'm saying listen closely to the State of the Union. I think you'll find it very exciting.
And if last year's 80-minute speech was any indication, it could be another long address. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News at the White House.
This news from VOA Asia. In case you missed it, the New England Patriots are celebrating a sixth Super Bowl victory after winning a tough defensive battle against the Los Angeles Rams in Super Bowl 53. They had a score of 13-3. 41-year-old quarterback Tom Brady led the Pats to all six of their championships. Receiver Julian Edelman was named the game's most valuable player. You'll find more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Monday marked World Cancer Day. As the World Health Organization issued new cancer pain control guidelines aimed at ending the needless suffering experienced by millions of people afflicted with this illness. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Cancer is a leading cause of death globally. The World Health Organization reports there are more than 18 million new cases every year and 9.6 million deaths, most in low or middle-income countries. Great advances have been made in the treatment of cancer, but measures to relieve the horrific pain experienced by patients lag woefully behind. WHO hopes to remedy this with its new guidance on pain management. Director of WHO's Department for the Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Etienne Krug, says controlling pain should be an essential part of cancer treatment. Yet, he says, pain is very often neglected as part of that treatment, a situation he considers unacceptable.
Nobody, cancer patients or not cancer patients, who should live or die in pain in the 21st century. So we have the knowledge of how to treat pain. We have the medicines of how to address it. It's a question of making sure everybody has that knowledge and everybody has access to the necessary treatment.
Kirk says the situation is most acute in the poorer countries because pain management systems tend not to be in place. But he notes even in the rich countries, people are still living and dying in pain. WHO says opioid painkillers like oral morphine are an essential treatment for moderate to severe cancer pain. But WHO non-communicable coordinator Sharyana Varghese says some governments have enacted regulatory and legal barriers against their use in reaction to the global scare of opioid and morphine addiction.
When a government of a country wants to introduce opioids, there is always this looming danger that this is going to get out of hand. And so the governments are more conservative because of this.
Varghese says there are sufficient safeguards against the abuse of opioids and morphine. He says these painkillers should be given only by trained healthcare providers, doctors and nurses. He adds oral preparation should be given whenever possible to prevent addiction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Finding a comfortable working environment can sometimes be difficult, especially for women working in male-dominated fields like science and technology. But some new startups are all about creating spaces that cater to and are dominated by women. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This is the Riveter Workspace, a unique shared space that allows women and women-owned businesses to gather and work together.
We saw a real need to provide not only physical space, but also the greater community that comes with that to help support women first.
The idea of this Seattle-based startup is simple. This is open office space. Companies or individuals can rent space, anything from a desk to a large office, and work alongside other women.
So I recently started a business called Money Muse. It's basically financial literacy coaching and events for women.
Stephanie Zenos has a space here. She is no stranger to male-dominated workspaces.
Especially being in the space industry, it's male-dominated, and so my whole life I've been the only woman in the room. And I guess I wanted to change that. I wanted to see what it was like to be around a community of strong, you know, badass women, and see what that was like.
The businesses are as diverse as the clientele.
We use graphic design to help global health organizations.
It is a curated rental clothing service.
People like Jamie Russo, who study workplace evolution, see this as a natural evolution.
As you start to learn more and the market starts to evolve, there start to be more options that are a little more specific or niche-y to fit what specifically someone might be looking for. So the women-focused spaces are a great example.
Stephanie Zenos sees it as an outgrowth of the kind of female empowerment that led to the Me Too movement.
And I know, you know, with sexual harassment, it's a big problem in a lot of industries and in a lot of places. And oftentimes you don't get support from women, even as a victim of sexual harassment. So I think now that Kat's kind of out of the bag, women are being more supportive of others outwardly.
And while the Riveter was created for women, company leaders point out that men are welcome too, and that about a quarter of Riveter's members are men. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook and, of course, our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio, Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. We thank everyone there who has tuned into our program today. And, of course, we send our thanks out to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer, Aydin Utku, Managing Editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.